Hey there, this is Future David. By that I mean that this is David from roughly 1 year after this particular show was recorded. You're about to hear an incredible conversation with Basecamp CEO and New York Times bestselling author Jason Fried, and this is my most popular episode. So in case you're new, I want to quickly remind you that I have more great shows with incredible entrepreneurs and creators. I am not a podcast factory, and I handpick the guests that are the most original thinkers, that have the most compelling stories, and that have the best lessons to teach. And I put a ton of preparation into each conversation, and I hope they resonate with you. So after you're done enjoying this episode, you may want to try another. So some big names that you've probably heard before: Steve Case, former America Online CEO, was on episode 25. Noah Kagan, founder of AppSumo and SumoMe, on episode 41. Ryan Holiday, author of Ego is the Enemy and Obstacle is the Way, on episode 31. Laura Roeder, founder of Meet Edgar, former speaker at the White House, is on episode 9. Cards Against Humanity co-creator Max Temkin is on episode 45. And at the time of this here future recording, I have a couple of episodes forthcoming, and they might not be out yet, so if not, make sure you hit the subscribe button so you don't miss them. World-renowned behavioral economist, many-time TED speaker, author of Predictably Irrational, and my former colleague, Dan Ariely, is on episode 51. I have an interview with James Altucher in the can. He'll be on episode 53. And there are many, many other episodes with exciting and bold entrepreneurs and creators. More than I can tell you at the moment, but be sure to check them out. And we now resume with the very first episode of Love Your Work, a conversation with Jason Fried. This is Love Your Work. On this show, we meet people who have carved out success by their own definition. I'm David Cadavy, best-selling author and entrepreneur. This is the first episode of the show, so if you're not familiar with me, I wrote a book called Design for Hackers, which is a bestseller. It debuted in the top 20 on all of Amazon. Before that, I was the lead designer for a couple of startups in Silicon Valley, and I freelanced as well. I blog at cadavy.net. That's K-A-D as in David, A-V as in Victor, Y, and you can tell how many times I've repeated that in my life. And you can follow me on Twitter at cadavy, or you can join 60,000 others and take my free design course at designforhackers.com. One thing that's really important to me is helping people build a business and a lifestyle that suits them. It's something that I've managed to do, and I want more people to experience it. And that's kind of the idea behind the show. With this show, I want to introduce you to people who have created businesses and lifestyles that are all their own. They've achieved success by their own definition and built a life according to their own values. They're not necessarily going to be millionaires, but they will be happy people. As the name of the show would imply, they love their work, and also I love their work. Now, to help us get this show off to a great start, can I ask you a favor? In this first few weeks of the show, we have the opportunity to be featured in the iTunes store in their new and noteworthy section. And this show is a bit of an experiment. I'm launching with a few episodes and going to see how it goes. Well, this first few weeks is absolutely critical. This is the one chance in the lifetime of this show to really bring in more listeners, and more listeners means I can put more of my energy into bringing you great guests with wisdom to share. But in order for that to happen, we need reviews on iTunes. Lots of them. They also have to be positive reviews, but that's, of course, up to you and the actual quality of this show. So can you please review the show on the iTunes store? If you loved it and want to hear more, please give it 5 stars. I'm very grateful to bring you this first guest. He is one of my biggest heroes, and he's the perfect example of someone who has built a business and a life according to his own values. Jason Fried, yes, the Jason Fried, hardly needs an introduction. He is the CEO of Basecamp and a New York Times best-selling author. Jason co-founded Basecamp way back in 1999. It was originally a web design shop, but they built a little project management app called Basecamp, and now that's the focus of the company. In the process of building Basecamp, the company also created Ruby on Rails, which is an open-source web framework that powers thousands of sites. And the thing I admire most about Jason is his contrarian thinking. Whatever the prevailing wisdom is, Jason seems to speak up and explain why that wisdom is wrong. He intentionally has set up his company small. His employees can live and work wherever they want, and they get a 3-day week during the summer months. And the company is almost totally bootstrapped. I say almost, because they did take a little bit of investment from the one and only Jeff Bezos of Amazon, primarily just to be able to give him a call once in a while. And Jason has co-authored 3 books, one of which is the New York Times bestselling Rework, in which he and his co-founder, David Heinemeier Hansson, share their rules for running a simple business. This interview is about 1 hour long, and there was so much more that I wanted to ask Jason. It could have been several hours easily. We talk about Basecamp a bit in the beginning, which you may already be intimately familiar with, but stick it out, and we soon start digging into the source of Jason's famously contrarian thinking. And I'm really fascinated by where it comes from, because I'm someone who tends to be a bit contrarian myself, but these thoughts, they usually come only after I have this deep internal conflict. And it seems like it just comes so naturally to Jason. So that's something that I try to unpack in the interview. And you're going to find some good tips for listening to that little mischievous voice in your head. And if you aren't already familiar with Jason, prepare yourself. He just really spews brilliance. Everything that comes out of his mouth could be quoted, or it could be a tweet, or it could be the subject of a blog post. He's really easy to interview, which is great because he's one of the first people that I've interviewed. So I'm very excited to bring you this interview. Let's get started. Okay, so I'm here with Jason Fried in the Basecamp offices, and I look around here and there's this beautiful wood paneling, and it's just a quiet office, and I can't help but notice there's nobody here.
No one's here. One person's here, but he's at lunch. But
oh, yeah. Okay. That person's at lunch.
That person's at lunch.
And, well, I mean, we are talking here on the day before Thanksgiving, so I wonder if that has something to do with it.
A little bit, but also, you know, most of the people, even who work in Chicago, work remotely. So we're a remote company.
Yeah.
People across 30-some-odd different cities around the world.
Yeah.
And including the people who are here, we have 14 people in Chicago. Usually any given day, there's 5 of them here, and it might be a different 5 each day, but that's how we work here, yeah.
Wow, 5 people. Okay, and this is a huge office.
It's a big office. Yeah, so we have 50 people in the company, and we all get together twice a year. So we have an office that's built to handle the whole company, but a very small portion of the company is in the office on any given day. Yeah. Half the office, too, is dedicated to public space. So we have a theater, got a big kitchen area, reception area. So it is still a large office, though.
Yeah, and I mean, we're in Chicago, so there's a little more space.
Yes.
A little more space available. So you guys have had this office for how long now?
Since 2010, August of 2010.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's quiet, there's lots of space, there's lots of private spaces as well. To what extent do you feel like this office kind of is an expression of your own personality?
Yeah. Well, I think it's an expression of the company's personality, which is probably derived at some point from mine, since I was one of the founders. But mostly, we're kind of a good, you know, introverted group for the most part. Definitely have some extroverted people here as well. But we try to be respectful of one another's space and privacy and time. And so, you know, we kind of treat the office like a library, and that the rules here are kind of like library rules, which is that you walk into a library, everyone knows how to behave. You're respectful of one another, you're quiet, you don't interrupt people. You know, people are studying and thinking and working, and that's the same way the office here works. So for the most part, even if it's full of people, it's pretty quiet and pretty hush. And then people can go into these private rooms like you and I are sitting in right now and have a full volume conversation without interrupting people on the outside. Just like a library, they have little side rooms where you can sort of talk loudly and not interrupt mm-hmm. people who are listening or who are reading outside.
Yeah, that was always something that bothered me whenever I worked at a company. I might have a bunch of different roles, but I might be ears deep in some code, and somebody would come up and tap me on the shoulder and interrupt me and just lose all of it.
You lose it all. You lose the focus, the zone, and so we want to protect that because that's a really hard thing to get into in the first place.
Yeah.
So if you're in that, we want to make sure that you stay in that as long as possible versus inviting interruptions all day long, which is what a lot of modern offices are all about these days.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that. I've noticed that before. And so you guys started out as a software sort of consultancy, right? Or web design.
Yeah, we started as a web design company.
And that was called 37 Signals.
Yep, in 1999 we launched the company in August. And we were doing website design for hire. But just redesign work for the most part. So we weren't doing programming. We were just doing visual redesigns. So mm-hmm. people already had sites, and we're like, we can make that site a little bit better. And so they would hire us to do that.
Yeah, and then now you are concentrated entirely, pretty much, on this one product, Basecamp.
Yeah, Basecamp. And Basecamp 3, the third version of that, just launched a couple weeks ago. So
every
4 years or so, we completely reinvent the product from the ground up. Not a single line of code, not a single piece of design is shared. We make it all over again every 4 years, roughly. So we just did that for our third major time. Basecamp's been around for 12 years. Came out in February 2004. So about 12 years total now. And so we're on the third major version.
That's funny. I guess I hadn't noticed that you reinvent the whole product every 4 years.
There's
like that.
Similar themes. So it's a lot like, you know, think about cars. So, like, we'll take the Porsche 911. Porsche 911 was released in 1963. It's about 52 years old now, okay? But there's been seven generations of the Porsche 911, okay? So every 7 years, roughly, they do a new chassis, they do new engines, they do new technology around it. Mm-hmm. But it's still a Porsche 911. It looks roughly the same. The engine's in the back. The driving dynamics are similar. You can identify a 911 that was made today and a 911 that was made 50 years ago. You can tell that there's continuity. But roughly every 7 years, it's an entirely new car. And the same thing is true for like a Honda Accord or a Civic. These lines have been around for decades. But every 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years, in cars it's more like 5 to 8 years because it's very expensive to make a new car. They make a new car. It's still an Accord, which means it's a four-door. Primarily they have a coupe version too, but it's like a family car and the Civic's a little bit smaller. They have these themes and these spirits around the things, but they're all new. And so that's what we do with Basecamp, is that Basecamp today in 2015 can trace back to Basecamp Classic, which is the first version of Basecamp in February 2004. The themes are similar. But the product is reconsidered in a big way every 4 years. And in between that, we just sort of improve the existing version. But then there's a point where you can't pack new ideas onto an old chassis, so you kind of redo the thing mm-hmm. from scratch.
Yeah, that car analogy is interesting. I'm not totally up on the designs of cars, but I imagine that, you know, say a Honda Accord, like there's certain values that are portrayed, values about what a car is and what is important in a car being portrayed in that, and then there's all this changing technology, and then there's certain trends maybe that are influenced by other
exactly
what the drivers are used to.
Yep.
That those sort of things change, and so that sort of calls for a total redo.
Totally. And you think about, like, I think just cars are really good metaphors for this, because you think about like the Corvette, which has been around I think since the 50s. And like there's a spirit to that car. It's a two-door sports car. It's like kind of a long nose. Like there's a spirit to it. And even though like they don't all look the same over the years, like there's a language and an idea behind the Corvette which stays mm-hmm. in the DNA of the car. But the car is redesigned and re-engineered completely from the ground up every 7 years or something. That's just how most industries work the same way.
Yeah, I mean, they're still positioned in a way against other types of cars, right? The Corvette is a different thing from a Camaro, right? It's
yes.
a different type of person that will drive it, and it's different sort of values that person has.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. But each car has its spirit. It's much like, look, you are not the same person. Now, I'm not even talking like personality. You don't share a single cell in common with yourself from 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Right? So you're actually, but you're still David. You're still the same guy.
Sure.
You've changed. Your tastes have changed and your points of view have changed, right? But it's still you, even though you've been completely re-engineered from the ground up in many ways all the time. You know, and so that's, you know, so there's iterative tweaks, and then at a certain point, like, you're all new. You're actually all new compared to what you were 10 years ago.
Yeah. So let's talk about that.
That's a little bit of a weird analogy. Let's stick to the car one. But
yeah.
that's really, you know, that's kind of what we're trying to do here. Instead of the alternative, which is typically how software works, which is that it's constantly iterated on, which is good, but that's when the code base gets really difficult to work on at a certain point because it gets old and the technologies that you're built on are kind of old and it becomes hard to work on. You begin to slow down and like it can't handle brand new ideas because you try and fit them into the current patterns and it's like, but this won't quite fit anymore. So you kind of shoehorn it in and then you make compromises and that's how things start to get bad over a certain point of time.
Yeah, I mean, so let's talk about that DNA then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Basecamp, for those who aren't familiar, is a project management web app, basically.
Yep.
Right. I mean, there's probably
iOS and Android apps. Yeah, all that stuff now too.
And you know, when you started, it's like your main competitor was maybe Microsoft Project.
Main competitor's always been the same.
Oh, okay.
Email.
Email. Okay.
Email and habits.
But when people would think of project management, would they think of email back when you guys were first starting?
If you ask people even today, like what their primary method of working on projects with people, it's still email.
Oh, okay.
So email is still the biggest. Our industry thinks like there are certain products of the time that are the big product, but the biggest of them all is email. And that's not a product, it's like a thing.
It's a protocol. Right?
But that is the thing you're always battling against, is like email, phone, in-person, habits. That's the thing you're battling most against. The biggest thing that you're trying to do is sort of there's this idea of non-consumption, which is this concept that there are people out there who work with others and they need a better way to do that, but they don't know how to do it. They don't use any products to do it yet. I mean, they use like products, but they use, you know, products that are not built for this purpose, but they just use like other things. And they don't even realize that there's something out there that would help them. Mm-hmm. They just don't, they're non-consumers. They want to consume, they want something better, but they don't even know something exists. So our industry sometimes thinks that whatever the hot product of the moment is, that everybody uses that. But actually, all things told, a very small slice of people use that, and most people don't use anything. So that's always like the biggest competition, in our opinion, is the people who don't use anything.
And I feel like there's a parallel that could be drawn there with between email and what we were talking about with office interruptions. You know, the email is this sort of portal where anybody can interrupt you.
Sure.
And you're providing a space through which everything is about this project that you're working on right now, all the communication that's happening and all that within Basecamp.
Yeah.
What is that DNA of Basecamp?
Yeah. So here's the thing. So the DNA of Basecamp, there's a couple things going on here. No matter what it is that you're working on, okay, if you have a team, there's a few things you need to do. Okay, I don't care if you are building a building, or you're working on a small school project, or you are putting together a publication, or you're building a website. Like, when you work with people, you've got people problems, all right? So you need a way to divvy up and organize the work that needs to get done amongst the group, okay? And our take on that is to-dos. But let's forget our implementation for a moment and just get back to the fundamentals. So you got a group of people, you want to do some work together, whatever it is. You've got chunks of work, pieces of work that need to be outlined and divvied up in some way and assigned out, okay? You need a way to hash things out quickly. So sometimes you just need to like hash stuff out and go informally back and forth really fast, right? Sometimes you need to like slow down and like present something and think about something and pitch something and write a thoughtful post or something and give people a chance to write back in time. So there's moments when you need to make announcements, there's moments you need to hash stuff out quickly. You need to keep track of like when things are due and what the major milestones are, what's coming up next, when is this thing launching, or when are we doing this thing together, right? So there's like some dates around it. There's artifacts, there's like files and there's documents and there's sketches and there's just PDFs and there's stuff that typically like you need to keep track of that stuff. You want to organize that stuff. You need a place where everyone knows where it is and where to go to get it and that sort of thing, right? And then finally, you need a way to like check in on people, like how's it going and how are we doing and are we doing the right thing and how do you feel about how we're doing it and are you stuck on anything, like those kind of things. So like to me, it doesn't matter the kind of work. When you work with people, those are the things, right? Hashing stuff out, divvying up work, dates, artifacts, making announcements, being able to get a hold of people when you need to, no matter what their speeds are, that sort of thing, right? So that to me is the DNA of what Basecamp's about. It's about understanding how groups actually work together to make progress on something. Not just, there's a difference too, because there's like moments when you're just social and you're just kind of like social. You're not trying to make progress there. But when you want to make progress on something, Basecamp comes in and helps you make progress on things with other people.
Yeah, and I like that you're...
It's a collection. It's really a collection. That's the thing that's always set Basecamp apart, is that it's a collection of unique tools that work together to help a group make progress on something together. Mm-hmm. There's many ways to approach things. There's like a way to piece together a bunch of separate tools and duct tape them together and try to like point at each thing, and you know, or there's like a way to like buy something that kind of tries to do all those things really well in a simple way, and that's kind of our side. It's like, we want to give you one thing that you can use to do all these things together with a group, versus you having to go out and shop for a bunch of different solutions and try and tie them all together and get people on board on five or six different products.
And it sounds like you've been able to really think about the abstract needs that are there and separate that experience from the technology itself. It's not Ajax. It's not,
right.
to use like a very 2002 term.
Very early, yeah.
It's not Ajax. It's not about, you know, all these individual technologies or something. It is managing these sort of abstract things that are floating in the ether and making them into something that you can get a handle on.
And getting your head around it and getting organized around it is a really important part of working together with people. The thing is that everyone can have their own individual messes, right? But if you bring someone else into your mess, they're going to be like, whoa, I don't know where things are. So you need to have like an organized place, a space, a shared place where you can do this kind of work. But yeah, it's not about technologies. It's not even necessarily about individual feature sets, because when I say like hash things out quickly, what I actually mean is in our implementation is more of like chat. Campfires are now in Basecamp 3. But in 5 years, chat may not be the way to hash things out quickly. There may be another way to hash things out quickly. So it's not about staying true to a tool set. It's about staying true to the problems you're trying to solve. And then, like, this is what gives us the opportunity to resolve those in new ways.
You have to apply it with the technology at hand.
Exactly. So,
just like the cars, that they change over time with technology.
Yeah, like Bluetooth wasn't a thing in cars 8 years ago. Now it is. Like, now, you know, navigation wasn't a common thing, and now it's like in almost every car. So technology moves, ideas move, and, you know, things you can do change. And that's why I think forcing yourself to reinvent yourself and be willing to look at those technologies and those new options on a regular basis is very valuable.
Now, when I think about you reinventing the product every 4 years, I can't help but think about how most people would react to doing something like that, or the idea of doing something like that. They would be so scared that everybody would be so pissed when you changed everything. Or that they'd be afraid to make a change like that.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get over that?
So yeah, it's a great question. And the way to get around that is to, again, get back to people. People do not like to be forced into change. People don't mind change. People hate forced change. Mm. So we never force anyone to switch versions of Basecamp.
Yeah.
People who've been using Basecamp, we have customers who've been using Basecamp for 12 years. Same version. They signed up for Basecamp when it was just called Basecamp. Now it's called Basecamp Classic, which is the original version. We've never forced anyone on Basecamp Classic to move to Basecamp 2, and no one's on Basecamp 2 has to move to Basecamp 3. We've made a commitment to our customers to always maintain every major version of Basecamp forever. So if you're happy with Classic, like, our definition of new may not matter to you. New doesn't matter to you. Consistency might matter to you.
But the new customers, it would be to your detriment to have the original interface with the technology of 2002 or whenever it was.
Four, yeah,
2004,
exactly.
And you know, somebody shows up and that's what you've got,
totally.
That would be a problem.
So new customers today who go to Basecamp.com will be signing up for Basecamp 3. That's the only thing they can sign up for. The newest, latest, greatest version of Basecamp we've ever made before. Customers who've been with us from 2004, some of them might still be on Classic if they've chosen to. Some of them might be on Basecamp 2 if they've chosen to be. Up to them completely, entirely. So that's how we solve that problem. We don't force change on anybody ever.
And you don't run into situations where that backwards compatibility is just impossible to support?
We don't support backwards compatibility.
Or so, maybe I'm using the wrong terminology there. But
yeah, if you start on 3, you can't like move to Classic.
Yeah.
Because there's not feature parity. There's different, like, for example, in Basecamp 3, you can assign, this is a small example, but you can assign two to-dos to many people. In Classic, you can only assign to-dos to one person. So if you're in Basecamp 3 and you assign to-dos to six people, a to-do to six people, and you tried to go back to Classic somehow, like, you'd lose data.
Yeah.
Because we wouldn't know where to foot. So you can't move backwards in time.
So you've been doing this for a long time. Basecamp has been around for 12 years itself. The company has been around
16 years. Yeah.
This reinventing every 4 years, is that something that helps you keep it fresh and keep it being something that you want to be doing every day?
Yeah, it's for everybody. So it's partially for us. We want to it's fun to make something new, and it's fun to improve that thing for a while. But at a certain point, you want to make something new again, right? Yeah. And the way we did it in the past was we kept making new products. So we made Basecamp, then we made Backpack, then we made Campfire, then we made Hi-Rise, and then we made job boards, and we've made a variety of things over the years. And what ends up happening, though, is that making something is actually the easy part. The hard part is then once it's out in the wild, you've got to maintain it. You've got customers using it. They have demands, and you've got to provide customer service and support and all these things. So we love the act of making new things, but we've decided that we want to focus on making one new thing over and over. Mm-hmm. And so that's how we kind of keep it fresh for us. Also keep it fresh for the market and keep it fresh for customers, and but also not ever upset existing customers by forcing them onto something new that they're not ready for or they don't want to be in. Well, something I learned early on, and it's sort of a ridiculous revelation because you just sort of expect that you would know this, but it's one of the things you just don't think about. Software companies especially almost never think about this. People are always in the middle of something, right? So if I release a brand new version, and they're in the middle of a project and they're trying to work on a client project with somebody, and like we release a new version, we push them onto the new one, like they're in the middle of something else. Like they're not ready to move to this. They don't want their software to change in the middle of their project. And so once we realize that, we realize like, okay, that's a deep insight and very important. Our product is not their lives. Their lives is their livelihood. The work that they do for their clients is what's important to them. And they don't want the software tool that's aiding them all of a sudden changing on them in the middle, because that's really disruptive and anxiety producing and stuff. So that's why we don't force anyone to change. So kind of you got to get to those human insights. And like the thing I've noticed most is that the things that drive people away are fear and anxiety. And it's not about like you don't have this feature, you don't have that feature. It's like the fear and anxiety attached to forcing me to shift or forcing me to change or forcing me to switch or forcing me to do something I'm not ready for. Mm-hmm. That's where people really recoil.
Not having control.
Yeah. People don't want to be in a situation where someone's changing up underneath them that they rely on. That's a really uncomfortable feeling. Right. It's like an earthquake. You know, you live somewhere, you rely on the ground to be solid. You know, you trust that the ground will be solid. And then one day the ground starts to shake. And that is terrifying because you can't do any. You can't go hide from that.
Have you experienced a couple earthquakes before?
I have, and it's terrifying.
Yeah, I have too. It's terrifying. And they weren't even big ones.
No, and right, because like it's I'm a Midwesterner, so a small one is a big one for me, right?
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, if it's really crappy weather-wise outside, you can like kind of go inside and hide, but you cannot hide when the earth beneath you moves.
Yes.
And that's a terrible feeling, and that's what software's like to people when there's this thing that they've been relying on that's been consistently working a certain way, and all of a sudden it changes on them, that's an earthquake. We don't want to create earthquakes for customers.
Yeah, especially this thing that they're relying upon to help them
do their job.
Do their work, to manage their projects. If I'm using a bad word there, I don't know, but
totally fine. Yeah, I mean, actually, what's interesting is we've gone away from the word project, which maybe we can talk about in a little bit. But yeah, fundamentally, absolutely, people use Basecamp to run projects, and they use it for other things too. But imagine if you're doing work for a client. You're a designer. You do work for a client. You've trained the client on this thing. You've told them this is how it's going to work. This is a client relationship, which is often, you know, delicate. They're paying you a lot of money. Like, you might be friends with them, but it's still a delicate relationship at some level. And all of a sudden, this thing that you told them was going to work one way, all of a sudden works a different way on Tuesday than it did on Monday. That is a bad situation. So we don't ever want to put our customers in those situations.
Right.
Yeah.
So you've definitely gotten really comfortable over all these years with your particular way of doing things. But I want to kind of step back a little bit further and kind of get an idea of where it all comes from. You know, I'd say that you're probably known for being a contrarian thinker. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, probably. I think people, I mean, it's funny because like, I don't think my ideas are contrarian at all, of course.
Yeah.
Right? But yeah,
right.
But against our, let's call it against our industry, yes.
Yeah, and you know, I think that a lot of people have thoughts from time to time where there's sort of a prevailing wisdom, and they think, well, that doesn't seem right. But then I think a lot of people don't, they bottle up inside, or they don't act upon it. They don't give themselves the permission and the confidence to go ahead and say, like, I don't think it should be that way. It should be this other way, and to go ahead with it. And I think that that's something, you know, if you go back and look at the 37 signals, which is the former name of the company, 37signals.com/manifesto,
yep.
there's all these things about, you know, we're small on purpose and all these things that are against the prevailing wisdom, that we purposely are not full service.
Right.
Things like that.
And even, by the way, even that site itself was, that's probably actually, that site is the most contrarian thing we've ever done.
Yeah.
We're a web design company. There wasn't a piece of work on that site. It was black and white. It was all text. 37 ideas is what that was. And if you think about back then, that was 99. Web design firms even today, like
1999, for those who can't remember.
Right, 1999. It was a previous century. But even today, it's all the same. Like, basically, agency sites are portfolio sites for the most part, which is like, here's our shining work, and here's the work we've been doing, and here's pictures of it, and like, I get that. We didn't have a single picture of any work that we'd done on that site. And the whole idea was that everyone's work pretty much looks the same. If it's good, it's like roughly the same, right?
Yeah.
But what sets companies apart and people apart, I think, are the ideas that they have. And most companies don't think the way we thought. And so we want to put our ideas out there to make us appear different and to attract the kind of customers that we want to work with, who are people who would appreciate this kind of thinking, versus just someone who would appreciate a pretty picture of a website that we made. That doesn't help us self-select our clients. So that was the idea behind that.
Yeah, and I think this is something that's so important for people to master, to be able to have a thought that's different from the prevailing wisdom and to give themselves permission to go forth with it. So, you know, take us back to 1999 when you decided to make this alt text. Was that something, did you know that it was something different from the prevailing way to do it? And how did you arrive at that and give yourself permission to do that?
Great question. We knew it was different. We knew no one had ever done anything like that before. And these were, it's funny, they're almost like tweets. Or like short blog posts. They were just like these really short thoughts. And, you know, we weren't trying to be different. We just realized that we were. And then we're like, so one of our partners, originally one of my partners in the business, was a guy named Carlos Segura, who's a graphic designer in Chicago. Yeah. And he has a line that says, communication that doesn't take a chance doesn't stand a chance. That's like his motto. And that drove us early on, which is like, let's take a shot. Like, what do we have to lose here? About like, what we actually have to lose is not being ourselves. And that is a bigger loss than being yourself and not getting traction. Like, if we were trying to act like everyone else, then we weren't really being ourselves, and that's the loss. So let's take a shot at putting ourselves out there, doing this differently, and let's see who we attract this way. Let's see, you know, let's put a different, everyone's fishing with this lure, let's put a different lure on and see what we attract, and maybe we attract some big fish that no one else knows how to attract, because everyone thinks the only way to attract this kind of fish is this way. And it turned out that we landed a couple big projects, and we've been profitable as a company ever since then because of that.
Yeah.
And it was, looking back, it's a bold move, but at the time, we just didn't think it was bold. We're like, we have nothing. We have nothing yet. We have no company yet. So we have nothing to lose. So let's take a shot. It's a lot easier now to be hesitant, in my opinion, to like be hesitant and being afraid to take a risk when you have something to lose. Like, we have something to lose. We've got a great business. We've got a lot of customers. We've got a reputation. Like, we can lose that now. And then you get a little bit tight. So we've tightened up as a company over the years. I think most companies do. But when you're fresh and brand new, like, that's the time to take a real shot. Why not, you know?
I mean, it's funny to think about that thought process that you had, because, you know, how old were you then?
25.
You know, when I was, maybe around 25 is when I started to wise up to, okay, these thoughts that I have in my head that are different from the way other people are doing things, I should do something to pursue those. But, you know, I think before that, I allowed other people's ideas of what success was or what it meant to, you know, what I should be doing. I think I allowed those ideas to, I allowed those ideas to dictate my own actions and put me in situations that that didn't make me happy.
Mm-hmm.
So did you ever experience that sort of thing where you were maybe making decisions based on what somebody else had decided?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, before 37 Signals, I was just a freelancer doing website design on my own, and I always referred to me as we. I was always like, when I was doing proposals, I'm like, we will provide a, you know, we will, because I always felt like I had to act bigger. I had to act like I was a company. I mean, it wasn't a company. I was me. It was just me. And, you know, I just thought I had to be something else. And I thought, I remember at the time, you've been around for a while too, you might remember there was something called US Web, which was like kind of wrapping up. It was like the first, it was like wrapping up all these small web design firms, trying to make this like big web agency made of.
Oh, wow.
Do you kind of, I don't know if maybe you remember this.
I don't
barely remember
that. What year would that have been?
That was like mid-90s, late-90s sort of thing. It was like, there's
mid-90s,
all these.
I was like making web pages on my AOL space.
Yeah, but I mean, so was really, I. But it was like, anyway, it's this thing that didn't go anywhere, right?
Yeah.
But I'm like, wow, someone might like, my firm might be acquired by a conglomerate, or like this weird stupid shit I was thinking about at the time.
I remember wanting to work for Razorfish.
Yeah.
And like seeing like, oh, well, they have MTV as a client, or
totally,
they're doing all these big things. And actually my thing was Communication Arts magazine.
Sure,
as
CA.
A designer.
Absolutely.
I would pour through the pages and I'd write down every firm that was there, and I would go to the city and I would call them, try to get an interview.
I did the same thing.
Yeah.
I'd go through these, design annuals.
Yeah,
I'd go through these design annuals. And I was like, man, I wish I could do that kind of work. And that's actually how I met
Carlos. Exactly
the
way
that
I was.
Yeah, I think most people are that way. And I think it's good. I think it's like a good start. And then you come into your own at a certain point. And I think your mid-20s are actually a really healthy moment for that.
Yeah.
But before that, I was just like kind of wide-eyed and like excited and, you know, wanted to act bigger than I was and wanted to be more professional. This is a thing, like, I wanted to be more professional.
Yeah.
That's the thing you have when you're fresh out of school, you want to be a professional.
Right.
Which, like, I need to write, like, really long proposals, and I need to, like, talk in a certain way. I need to act a certain way. I need to appear bigger. And that's just insecurity. And it's natural. Like, you don't know. What do you know? You're 21, you're 20, whatever. You don't know anything yet, right? So you're trying to act. You're an actor. And then at a certain point, you become yourself. And I think that's when it's formative, is when you begin to realize, like, you know, I don't, and I realized this at some point. I realized it by accident. I was doing these long proposals, and because I thought that's what you had to do, like 20-page proposals. I remember like writing 20-page proposals about like.
Oh yeah, I've done a couple of those.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And you spend, I don't know, weeks and all-nighters, and like you write these proposals.
You don't get the job.
You don't get the job, right? And then I realized, like, first of all, I hate writing 20-page proposals. I think they're a waste of time because here's what happened to me. I was. I forget, my parents, I think, were doing like a kitchen renovation or something at home, and they were getting these proposals from contractors, and I saw them look at them, and all they did was they turned to the last page, like, how much is it going to cost, how long is it going to take?
Yeah.
That's all you care about when you get a proposal, because to get a proposal from somebody, you've already vetted them at a certain level, like, I'm curious about what they would do for me.
Yeah.
I know who they are, so like, what would they do? And you just want to know how much is it going to cost and how long is it going to take? So I realized this, I'm like, you know, I'm doing these 20-page proposals, I'm busting my ass on them, I don't like doing them. It's what you're supposed to do, right? Or is it? So I started doing shorter and shorter and shorter proposals and started winning jobs.
Mm.
And at the end of my freelance career, I was doing single-page proposals.
Yeah.
And I wasn't losing any business over them. And I realized, holy shit, I don't need to do what everyone else is doing. Like, I thought this is how you had to do it, but you don't have to do it that way. And that's like where I gave myself permission to go, well, what else I have to do that everybody else is doing?
Okay. This is exactly what I'm looking for here.
Yeah.
This is the time when you slowly started making the proposals shorter and shorter, and you realize that this thing that other people had told you was so, or somehow you had come to the conclusion was true, was in fact not true.
It was in fact not true. I don't even know if people
told
me, or I just like thought you, I don't even know. Like,
it was more than not true, it was false.
Like, it was false at a variety of levels. It was false that, like, I had to do that to get jobs.
Yeah.
It was false that I had to stay up late and bust my ass to get work. And it was also false that it would make me happy. Like, I was miserable making these long proposals. So I realized, if I can eliminate the misery and I don't have to stay up late and I can, like, be concise and get to the point and present my work clearly in a page or two, like, man, that's a bunch of wins. Plus, it's a win for the customer on the other side. Like, I know, and I told them that. Like, I'm like, look, I know how proposals are. Like, you're just going to look at the, I said this in my proposal. I'm like, I know how proposals are. Like,
you thumb through a bunch of stuff, and at the end of the day, you just look at the price and how long it's going to take, because you've already seen my work, because that's why you've asked me to submit a proposal. So I don't need to like go through all my work again. Here's how much it's going to cost. Here's how long it's going to take. And that was my pitch, basically. Like, look, let's cut through the bullshit, because that's going to represent how I'm going to work with you. I'm not going to bullshit you. I'm going to be direct and clear, and we're going to work concisely together. So it was like an embodiment of how we're going to work also. And that resonated with people. And then I started to realize, like, man, I don't have to be like everybody else. This opens up opportunities. Now, I didn't see all the other opportunities. It was just like a moment where, like, where I could like poke the way you're supposed to do it and get away with it. And they're like, ah, maybe I can do this more. And so I start doing
sort
more
of a sense of
like
mischief
that.
To it. It kind of makes things more fun that way.
Absolutely.
I know I'm that way where like if I get stuck in a rut, I just kind of say, well, I'm going to just like write this silly, mischievous blog post or email, and suddenly it feels fresh and people respond more.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this is something I'm actually thinking about here right now, which is like like next year, there's some stuff I want to do that doesn't seem like it would be a reasonable thing to do. Like it would be difficult to justify. In the same way that I think a single page proposal would be difficult to justify until you realize that it works. And then it becomes, of course, you don't have to justify it anymore because it becomes true. And so like there's a couple things, I'm being very vague here because I don't want to talk about it quite yet because I haven't formed the ideas
sure.
thoroughly, but there's a couple things I want to do that seem counterintuitive to our own company. That are in the way, our own way of working, that I want to sort of ruffle a bit.
Yeah, so it sounds like you're trying to kind of shake things up a little bit in the office. You don't want to get too complacent and doing things a certain way. Is that going to bring some freshness, or what's driving that?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's part of the whole, like, reinventing Basecamp is part of that, like, being on this schedule where we have to kind of reinvent Basecamp on a frequent basis. It's not that frequent, but, like, 4 years.
4 years
so,
is
right?
relatively.
But yeah, in this industry, sort of actually, it seems like a long time in some ways. But my opinions change over the years, and I have new ideas, and a thought comes to mind. And I've been doing some things that's been interesting is I've been doing a lot of in-person demos at Basecamp 3, which is, I've never really done a lot of in-person demos at Basecamp before, mm-hmm. and it's been really interesting because I'm seeing some really cool insights that come from follow-up questions that. We've always thought about demoing Basecamp with videos or tutorials or whatever, right? But what I've realized is that kind of demo doesn't lead to follow-up questions. And follow-up questions are really valuable because that is where someone requests or looks for clarity. Like, wait, what do you mean by that? Or like, wait, how do you do that? Or wait, how'd you think about that?
It's kind of like where they ask the question that they were initially too afraid to ask or something. Like,
that's a good way of
putting
it.
That they thought was a dumb question before, but somehow.
Totally. It's a great way of putting it. Yeah, great way of putting it. And that, like, those moments, I think, what I'm realizing are extremely valuable. Very valuable. In fact, it's almost all the value. Yet, when you do a lot of self-service stuff, you don't get to that value because you don't see talk to the person, right? So
see their facial expressions or...
Yeah, or just like the things that... It's like, you know, a comedian writes material and, you know, if they want to do an HBO... Or they want to do a one-hour show on HBO, like, they spend a year in the clubs, like, perfecting that material. They don't know how audience are... They think all the stuff they're writing on is funny, but they got to try that stuff out. You got to, like, try it out in front of an audience and see what reacts. And sometimes, like... audience gets a reaction on something that you didn't think was going to be that funny, or like they react to the timing or something, and you've got to try that stuff out. And so what's been interesting is I gave a couple demos of Basecamp 3, and one of the interesting features of Basecamp 3 is that you can, it's like such a basic thing, like you can create folders and you can drag things into folders to organize them your own way. And I got like a standing ovation from this one group and like I was really surprised by that. It was not something that I thought was going to be like this eureka moment for people,
yeah.
right? But I had to be there to see that, to feel it, to know that there's something there now. Like that's it. And then I could follow up on that and get like, wow. I'm like, whoa, why was that such a big deal for you? Like, oh, because, and then you get the because, and the because, like, after every word after because is gold, you know, and you don't get that when you just kind of like put material out there that people can do on their own. So I want to do a lot more in-person stuff next year. And this is stuff that does not scale. You can't, like, we have well over 100,000 paying customers. Like, we have a very big business, tons and tons of customers, millions of people use Basecamp. I can't possibly demo it for all of them, right? But I don't have to. What if I can demo Basecamp to 200 companies a year? What if I could do that? Like, how much better would the product be? How much better off would they be, and how much better off would we be? Like, I think it's undeniable that there'd be a deep value there, and I want to think about doing that kind of stuff. So anyway, that's very different from how we've ever done things before. Yeah. So it's just one of those things. That's just one of the things I'm thinking about. But I just feel like it's really important to shake up your own thoughts from time to time.
Yeah, and I love this idea of these insights of these things that you are taking for granted in a way. Because there's, you know, it was, for whatever reason, maybe it was an obvious solution to make the folders draggable like that, and then it just blows away these other people. And I think that that's something that I find that myself just in trying it, or I have found that in trying to find my own entrepreneurial voice or deciding what to do with in my own career, is that every once in a while somebody will like make an observation. They say, "Oh, you know, you're really good at explaining things," or something like that, and you're like, "Well, wait, I didn't."
I didn't know
that. Yeah. Was there anything like that for you personally that helped you find your own path at, you know, within the 37, maybe in the early days of 37 Signals or something, things that you didn't necessarily know that you were good at, but you later discovered through observations like that?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure if it's a specific thing other than like a way of looking at things. So we would do work for clients all the time, oftentimes bigger clients. Like back in the early days, we'd do work for Hewlett Packard or something. We did a website for them.
Yeah.
And I'd be sitting in a meeting with them, and there'd be a lot of people on the table, and they'd be talking stuff through, and they'd be like, you know, they'd be talking stuff through, putting the ideas through their own process, which often involved a lot of people and follow-up meetings and like a whole timetable to get something, to try something. And I'd be like, why don't we just try it right now? Like, why don't we just make the change right now and just like look at it together? And like that to me was like, oh, of course, like if we want to see how it looks, let's just do it and then let's look at it. And for them, that was just like a revelation. Like, what? Like, but it doesn't have to be this and that and improved. And I'm like, it could be, but it doesn't have to be. Let's just like right now, let me pull up my laptop and I'll make the change and I'll hit reload and let's look at the page. Like those things, like that came from me being a freelancer, which is like, I was working on my own. I had no one else to talk to, no one else to like rely on. I had to do it all myself. Like, I did all the HTML and design, and there was no process. So like for me, just growing up that way in the industry helped me realize that you don't need a lot of people to get things done. You don't need like a lot of process to try stuff. But a lot of the clients I worked with early on, like, they couldn't believe, like, they're like, you're a genius. I'm like, I'm not a genius at all. That is like the worst label to give me. I'm actually being a simpleton. I'm just being like, let's just change it and hit reload. But it wasn't like a thing. It was just a way of cutting through stuff. And what I saw there was that process creates layers and layers and layers upon which you then begin to rely, and you don't realize that there was a time when you didn't have to have all that layer, all those layers, but you become used to them and you think then that's the only way. And so I think what I was good at early on was coming in and like cutting through that stuff and being like, we don't need to do all that, let's just do it this way. And they'd be like, why? You're not allowed to do it that way.
Again, like, it goes to this contrarian thinking thing, which, you know, I'm trying to figure out like how much of it is your DNA and then how much of it was, you know, was there ever a time, I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, I think that, yeah, I can show a lot of people, here we're talking with Jason Fried, he sees things differently from the way other people do, but somebody can't just flip a switch and start thinking in their own way or gain that confidence. Was there ever a time when you didn't have the confidence to do that? And,
yeah.
And how'd that happen?
I mean, I've always had a worldview, I think, which is like things are simpler than they appear. actually, which is funny because they're also way more complicated than they appear. But like, I mean, what I mean by that is that things can be simpler. Like, yeah. Whatever the thing you're trying to solve, like, there's a simpler version of that. Like, I've just always had that in me that I'm like, there's no way this is the only way we can do this. We can do this simpler. We can do this clear. We can be clearer about this.
What do you think was like the earliest example you can think of where
of that
you did that?
So back before the web was around, the way I got started in any of this stuff was I made this program called Audiophile, which was a music organizing tool. It was like iTunes, kind of way, way back, but there was no digital music. So it was just like a way to organize your CDs and your tapes. Because yeah. I had a bunch, and I was loaning them out to friends and never getting
them
back.
Tapes, for people who don't know, was this thing that had two reels on it, and there was this tape-like thing.
It was actually
had music
tape.
On it.
Yeah. It was tape that moved.
It wasn't sticky.
Right.
But
it was magnetic and weird. So I would loan stuff out to friends and never get it back. And I didn't know who borrowed it, and I didn't know. So I'm like, I need to organize this stuff. I need to get my stuff together. So I started looking on AOL, actually, because the internet wasn't around. This is like the early 90s. And I'm like, AOL was around. There's like software boards and stuff where you could like download shareware and stuff. And I downloaded a bunch of these music apps because there was a lot of other people who had this problem. And I just found them incredibly complicated and just like really weird and strange and ugly and all the things. I mean, it's still subjective, but like my aesthetic was not being met by or was not being satisfied by their aesthetic. And like I don't know how to do this, but I need something, and I'm gonna make one myself. So I just like got FileMaker and learned how to do it and made like a much, 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 much simpler version because I just made something that I knew I needed. And it wasn't about imagining what everyone else needed. It was just like, what do I need? And I was able to cut right to that. And it became a very successful product. Mm-hmm. And like I made $20,000 off this little shareware thing.
Getting checks in the mail.
Yeah, and this was the revelation that I could do this for a living.
Yeah.
So I put in the product, it was shareware, which is like you could use it for free. And mm-hmm. But if you like it, send me $20. And here's my home address. Like I didn't know.
Yeah.
So people start sending me $20 bills. And I'm like, holy shit,
now,
I can do this.
Were there moments of doubt along the way? Or
never, because I didn't care.
You didn't care. It just happened.
It was for me.
Yeah.
Like the product was for me. And if no one used it, didn't care.
Yeah.
And that's how I've always tried to make it, which is like, we still make Basecamp for ourselves. And like, we need Basecamp to run our own business. And I mean, I care a lot more now because we have tons of customers and we've got a payroll, 50 people and the whole thing, right? But fundamentally, it's still like, we need to solve, we want to make something for ourselves because we know there's a lot of people out there just like us who need what we need. And like, that's how we look at it. But with Audiophile, the first thing ever, I mean, I was like, you know, in high school or whenever it was, and it's like, there was never a moment of doubt because it didn't matter if anyone used it. Mm-hmm. It was a miracle that anyone did. But I needed it for my own thing. And so that was all it wasn't even about confidence. It was like, I need it anyway. And then that's how I kind of learned graphic design and learned a little bit of software development and learned usability and learned about customer feedback and all the stuff I learned through those channels because I made my own little software thing.
So it seems like, so there were like no existential crises over like, oh, should I do this or that? And
well, I mean, I think the biggest one we had recently in the company was like deciding to go all in on Basecamp and what to do with the other products and stuff. So that was like, that wasn't like an existential thing, but it was like a moment and there was risk involved and all that stuff. And those moments still come up. I mean, deciding what to do in a product and, you know, do we release it this way or release it that way and how do we price it? Like, we have those discussions and decisions all the time, but I try not to worry about it too much. I worry about it probably more than I should still, but I, you know, it's like, let's make a call and move forward and see how it does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, I've got a few questions that are a little more canned questions as we wrap up. What's the biggest compromise that you've had to make in your career to have the success that you have?
Hmm. Well, the biggest compromise, that's a great, really great question. I've never been asked that question. I love when I've never been asked a question before. Those are great questions. So I made a compromise. I'll talk about inside the business. And this is interesting because it turned out to be a great thing. But So David, who's my business partner, like I had two partners originally in 37 Signals, and then they both left, and so it was just me. And taking on another partner was a compromise in some ways, because it's like, to me, like, I got this, I'm running the show now, and now I'm going to bring someone else in, and someone else's opinions are going to matter at that level. Mm-hmm. And so it was like...
And David, by the way, is, you know, could be called a contrarian thinker as well, right?
Absolutely.
So lots of opportunities for you to disagree.
Yeah, and we do disagree. We still disagree deeply on certain things. We agree on most things. And then there's some things around the edges that we disagree on deeply, which is really healthy. And that's my point, is that, like, sometimes it feels like I have to give, like, it would be easier if I could just do whatever I wanted, right? But the company wouldn't be better. And that's what I've come to realize. Like, and I realized it pretty early, but I remember, I'm just talking about the moment of thinking, taking on another partner again, was like this moment where I'd have to make compromises. And it turns out that compromises are actually really damn good things to make sometimes. Mm-hmm. But at the time, I just remember thinking, like, bringing something, like, I've got it all now. And this actually includes ownership of the company. Like, I owned 100% of the company, and David came on as a partner, and now he owns a piece, right? And he owned more and more over time. And, you know, looking back on it, it's one of the best decisions I've ever made. But I just remember, like, going back, thinking about...
There was a point of tension.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Like, internally.
It could have gone either way.
It could have gone either way. I also just, like, I talked to my dad about it, and my dad's always been someone who's, like, never have a partner in business, never take on a partner, because a lot of them dissolve, and it's really messy and horrible. And I've been really fortunate to always be able to work with great people. But it's, you know, this is not a compromise I've considered recently. Mm-hmm. Thrilled with how things turned out, but I just remember at the moment.
Yeah. Really, and the two of you had worked together before at that point. It wasn't just blindly going into this partnership.
No, yeah, we'd worked together, and I actually encourage people to do that. So I hired David
before getting married.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, and I'd hired David as a... David was still in school when I first met him, and I hired him. He only had 10 hours a week to give me as on a contract basis to build Basecamp. Actually, but before that, we were working on some client work together as a contractor, because we didn't have any programmers on staff, and he was the first programmer I'd ever worked with. And so we needed, his client hired us to build an intranet for them, and we're like, we can do the design. They're like, well, we want you to do the back end too. And I didn't know how to do that. And I found David, and he did it with us. Anyway, we had experience working together on multiple levels. But it's still, like, the moment you decide to bring someone into your business, it's like, as the founder, as the remaining founder, like, it's a difficult moment.
I'm thinking of it myself. I own 100% of my business, and it would be kind of agony to make a decision like that.
Totally. And I think there's still times, and I'll speak for David, although I'm guessing David feels the same way, that there's times David would just like to do things his own way, and there's times I'd like to do things my own way. But the fact that we can't do that, and we discuss these things with each other, we end up with something better.
Yeah.
But there's also, of course, frustrating moments for everybody in every relationship. I mean, it's a relationship, right? And that's cool. But it is important, I think, I think a lot of entrepreneurs these days look for founders that they haven't. They're like, I need a co-founder. I need a co-founder. I need a co-founder.
Yeah.
So they just go out and try and find one. Like, you got to date someone first, basically, for a while. I really think that's important because, you know, people are complicated, money is complicated, and people and money together is extremely complicated. There are few things in the world that are more complicated than that. And that's the kind of complication you're getting yourself into when you take on a partner in a business.
Yeah, it's almost like this commodity kind of approach to something that's so personal, or, you know, a person. A co-founder is like, oh, I'm just going to go grab some milk at the store.
Yeah, it's not that way.
Grab a co-founder.
It's not that way, especially like if you're in a business 50-50 or something, like a lot of people do. They start out like co-founder for 50-50. I actually think 50-50 is the worst number in business. Yeah. There needs to be tiebreakers.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's another topic. But anyway, so as far as compromises, to get back to that, like, that's, I think at the moment was a major compromise that I had to get over, but I'm so glad that I did. But it was a big moment.
Yeah. Well, that's a great one. I'm so flattered to have asked you a question that you hadn't been asked before.
I love that.
I'm sure you've been asked a lot of questions.
Yeah.
What was the last book that you read that changed the way that you saw something?
Oh, a great question too. So I typically do not like business books. I find them boring and too long. But I read something recently, which I don't even consider to be a business book. A book called...
It doesn't have to be a business book, by the way. It could be about... Adrian, who I talked to, said he read a book about ants. So
totally. And I know that book. And he told me about it, and it's on my list. But just, yeah, being honest about it, the last thing I read that really changed my mind on something happened to be a business book.
Gotcha.
Although, actually, can I give you two answers?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so one of them was a business book called Turn the Ship Around, which is a wonderful book by this guy named David Marquette, who was a captain on a nuclear sub. And he was brought in to turn the worst sub in the Navy around, like turn it from the worst sub in the Navy to the best. And the way they measured this was like sailor satisfaction, people who wanted to sail on that ship again. Like, there's a variety of things. I don't remember all the details, but it was like let's say there was 100 of them. It was number 100, the worst.
Yeah. Wow. Okay?
And they brought him in to make it great. And he did it by doing something extremely contrarian. So in the military, it's all about orders. You give orders.
Yes.
And in business is often structured a lot like military. There's like, the orders come from the CEO and we all follow the orders, right? And he realized that, like, look, there's 800 people on this ship. I'm, you know, one of those 800. If I'm the one giving orders, then there's only one brain on the ship. It's mine. And what a terrible waste to have 800 brains, but only one of them has to work. And everyone else just does what I say. That is a waste. So he decided not to give any orders, which is something the military, you don't do. Like, it's the opposite of what you do. The only order...
This sounds like a great book.
It's a wonderful book, and it's a great story, and he tells it. It's not a business book at all, by the way. It's not at all, but it's sort of
like...
Lots
of parallels.
Tons of parallels, but it's not a business book. But he talks about how the only order he reserved for himself was the order to fire a weapon that could kill somebody. So like that, if they had to fire a torpedo, that was still on him.
Yeah.
Everything else, what he did was, he said, and it took him a while to get over to make this work, which is what's really cool about the book, is he was very honest about the failings of it initially. He wanted to, after he enacted the system, he's like, everything in his bones told him, like, step in and fix these problems. But he's like, no, I got to let this settle out the way I wanted to. Anyway. Was that people were not to come. So the way it typically worked is people would come to him and they'd say, Captain, you know, what should I do? Or whatever it is. And he'd be like, turn the ship 30 degrees starboard or whatever. I don't know. And they'd be like, aye, aye, Captain. And they'd go do it, right? He'd give the order. But what he wanted people to do instead was to come to him and say, I intend to turn the ship 30 degrees. And then he could okay that. But the point is that his okay would just, like, they're already saying what they're going to do. Mm-hmm. They have to, in their mind, already know what they're going to do. They can't come to him to ask him what to do. They have to come to him and tell him what they intend to do.
They have to go through that whole mental process of...
Because if he says yes, I got to do this now.
Yeah.
And I came to him with the idea. So he got people to come with intent.
Accountability there.
Totally.
Well.
And think it through and come with intent. And
ownership.
That changed everything. Totally.
Yeah.
And they started thinking. And it took a while because it was like weird at first. And like, this is part of the thing is whenever you enact something new at a company, it's very easy to fall back on what, and this isn't going to work. This is too weird. Like, I'm going to, but he talked about the process of getting over that and giving it space and distance to see if it would work. And it turned out it worked and became the best ship in the Navy.
Oh, that's a great book.
It's a wonderful book.
I will read that book.
He's a wonderful writer and a very honest storyteller. So that there's that book. And the other book is, a book which has the cheesiest cover ever and also a very cheesy title. It's called The Mayo Clinic Guide to Stress-Free Living. And okay. It's like the cheesiest. The book cover is like someone doing a cartwheel in a field.
Stress-free living.
It's horrible. Yes. But it's this guy.
Is it made by the Church of Scientology?
It looks like it would be, but it's actually the Mayo Clinic, which is like the world's best hospital.
Yeah.
And this guy who wrote it is a doctor there. Who sort of unlocked a couple really interesting truths about the brain and how to reduce stress in your life. And it's fascinating and changed my life in terms of, like, I haven't mastered the techniques, but they've influenced me greatly. And the number one thing I'll tell you about it is that basically there's this sense that what he's sort of realized, and different sort of religions and theologies have sort of come to similar conclusions, but he sort of tried to make this very practical, is that there's two modes of the mind. There's the default mode and the focused mode. Okay. And the focused mode is when you're like working. And he talks about like when you're really into something, it's all you're thinking about and you're cruising and you're nailing it, right? But when you're not focused and you're wandering, your mind tends to wander towards worry. It tends to wander towards, you start having these thoughts in your head about like the things you should be doing and the things you're not doing and what's going to happen if I do this and oh my God, global warming, we're all going to die. And like you just start, your mind, because evolutionarily, like you're programmed to do that because if you're just
amygdala taking over.
Yeah, it's like there's a tiger who's going to kill me and I got to like, you know, I got to be wary. But he's like, in modern world, we don't have, most people don't have those things anymore. We're pretty safe. Not everywhere, but most places. Yeah. So you've got to get your mind off the default mode, which is the wandering mode, and back into focus mode. So he helps you figure out ways. And some people do meditation, and he's like, you know, meditation's a wonderful thing if you have all this time to commit to it and learn and really master it.
Is that something you've tried?
I have, and I've never been able to do it very well. Hmm. And so this really spoke to me because he's like, I think meditation's a wonderful technique, but it's not a practical technique for most people. And in fact, a lot of meditation is about just like letting your thoughts come and go. And like that's when you have a lot of the bad thoughts. And like it's very hard to really, really master that technique. So anyway, I'm not going to get into it deeply, but the book's wonderful. It's really, really approachable. And there's just some really good fundamental things that have sort of changed my way of dealing with those moments when I race towards bad thoughts, how to like deal with those in a practical way. Right. So anyway, those two books I'd highly recommend.
This is my first time asking this one. Do you make your bed?
No, I sometimes like throw my bed. Like I kind of just like flop the sheets so it sort of looks made up, but no, never been into that.
This is one of these things I've heard over and over again is like, oh, you should make your bed. And, you know, I started doing it.
It's like
kinda
a thing you
one of these things I never did when I was a kid because it was like, this is such a waste of time, Mom. I'm not going to make my bed.
Yeah, and the reason why I don't do it is because I don't like made beds. Like, I don't like, like, when I go to a hotel, the first thing I do is I tear the bed up.
Yeah, I
don't
kick like the sheets out from under. I hate having my feet trapped.
Me too. I don't like things tucked in and tight that way. So, like, I just kind of, like, would flop. I mean, I like it to be sort of semi-presentable at a certain level, but I don't... go through the details, and I certainly don't tuck things in.
Yeah. Maybe flatten it out a little bit.
A little bit, sometimes, but not all the time.
So it's not like all just bunched up.
Flop. Yeah, floppy.
Yeah, just flop it. When have you left money on the table?
All the time.
And what did you get in return? The reason, the question I'm really asking is, what sort of values have you guided? Because, you know, money is a certain value.
Sure.
And then... there are other values. What are the values that have guided your decision making?
Yeah, so I've never ever been someone who's been interested in squeezing the last dime or penny out of anything. Like I don't find that to be interesting at all. Like I don't find extreme optimization to be interesting. Like how can we move the numbers by 0.5% because there's money out there that we're not, you know, like that doesn't do it for me. And also I feel like there's a moment where like this is very non-scientific, but like you're doing well enough. It's about enough. We continue to make efforts to grow the business revenues, and we always have every year. Like our revenues are higher than the previous year, our profits are greater than the previous year. Like I'm a fan of that level of growth, but I'm not a fan of trying to like bust our ass to make 10% growth if naturally we can just do 8. Like if we can just do 8, I don't need 10. You know what I'm saying? Like I just don't need that. So
that last 10%, that last 2% is what ruins your life.
Exactly. And so like I've just realized that, hey, and even like I'm just making numbers here.
Yeah.
If we can do 5% growth, like I'm actually pretty happy with that. We do more than that. But like what if we did just do 5% every year forever? That's pretty damn good still. Like that's wonderful. Like fine. Like what if we could do 20% with a simple change? I'd love that. But I'm not going to bust my ass to try and go from 5 to 6. Like that just doesn't interest me. So those kind of things don't interest me. What interests me is having, I do believe in creating cushion. So I do like to have room. I don't like to feel like we're so tight that like payroll would be a problem. Like that isn't something I've never had to deal with and I don't want to deal with that. So I always want to create very healthy margins and lots of room to try and experiment and not struggle through those things. I've always worked that way, but I've never looked at the numbers and felt like I need to move the numbers in a meaningful way by squeezing. Yeah. So I'm not like I'm not a numbers driven CEO in terms of like going, oh, we're leaving, there's got to be able to pick up more. But I also think that there is plenty more to pick up, and I'm interested in picking it up as an exercise, but not because I feel like we must.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of how the value.
What do you feel like you get in exchange?
By the way, I'm also a big fan of just profit. So getting back to that, it's not, numbers for me had never been about top line growth or revenue. It's about profit, because profit to me is food, air, and water for a company. And it allows the company to continue indefinitely. And that's sort of what I want. Revenues do not do that. Profits do. So I'm very big into profit generation, yeah, and not just like trying to grow. Companies are like, I want to get to $700 million in revenues, so we're worth $44 billion. Like, if they're only making $3 million off all the effort that goes into making $700, that doesn't interest me.
Yeah.
Anyway. That was an aside there, but I forget what.
What do you feel like you get in exchange for leaving that money on the table?
A lot less stress, a lot less worry, those things.
Yeah.
And also just like, I think, time back, and also a focus on I think more important things like taking care of people. So like we do a lot of really interesting things for employees here that if I could not justify to a. If I was financially driven, I couldn't justify these expenses. Like we do some very expensive mm-hmm. things for employees, above and beyond salary, but above and beyond benefits, but like just other things. I don't need to go into them specifically, but they don't make sense from a financial standpoint, right? But they make sense to me as someone who wants to create great experiences for employees who spend their days working for me, and I get to work with them. So those are the things you get when you don't worry about those other things.
Do you have a final message for our listeners? Any parting words that you'd like to give?
Well, tell me about the listeners. Who are the listeners? Tell me about the audience.
Oh, the audience. Well, gosh, I don't know. That you really stumped me with that question, Jason. You know, I'm bringing in people like you, and the reason why you're going to be the first guest on this podcast is... because you're somebody who has played by your rules, and you have very clearly worked to achieve your own definition of success, which is evidence is abound in this interview, I think. And I'd like for people to see through you parallels in their own lives, like not for them to do the same thing that you're doing, but for them to give themselves permission to listen to whatever contrarian voice might be in their head or whatever new way they might have of seeing something, and to give themselves permission to go forth with it.
Yeah. I think that then if that's the goal of the show, I think the most important thing, and it took me a while to realize this in my own life, is just to be completely true to yourself and recognize that, like, you got to get to know who you are, and then you got to just live that life. And I don't mean like give up that's not what I mean by just live that life. But what I do mean is that, if you believe in doing things your way and that don't compute with the rest of the world, do things your way, because like, you know yourself and that's how you want to live. If you want to take a certain chance and everyone else thinks you're crazy, but you believe in it, then do it. Like, you really have to get to know yourself and answer to yourself versus letting other people define your own limits and in your borders. So I think that's, I mean, it's a little bit of a, it's a little self-helpy, which I don't like about it, but I mean, it's really true. Like, you've got to get to know yourself. And something I hear from people when I speak and they're like, oh, I want to be like you guys. I'm like, no, you don't. You want to be like you. You want to be like you, because acting is hard. Mm-hmm. Acting makes you have to hold a bunch of things in your head about a different state of the world that is not natural to you. And once you stop acting, then everything becomes a lot easier. And you may succeed and you may not, but at least you're being honest and true to yourself. That is the most important thing.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that because I know sitting across from you, you're somebody who I followed online for so long, and I was always watching what you were doing and reading what you wrote and things. And eventually I had to find my own way of doing things. I know that I'm not Jason Fried. I'm not going to do things the same way that Jason Fried does things.
Yeah, and you shouldn't.
Yeah,
you shouldn't. You should do things the way you do things. And I think there's a lot of copying in our industry. And I think there's a lot of people who try to be someone else. And this is probably not even just in our... I think this is just in the world, right? And I think the earlier you realize that that acting and playing a part is really hard, but being yourself is really easy, then like you should take the easy road. There's nothing wrong with that, and it's actually the more honest road, and I think that you'll ultimately be happier at the end of the day. So that's my advice to people.
That's great parting wisdom for everybody. Thanks so much for meeting with me. It's been a huge honor, and I think that's going to be a huge help to a lot of the listeners out there, so thanks so much.
And I let me say this too. I think your show has a lot of legs because you're a really good interviewer and you have really good deep questions and original questions. So I'm really excited to hear all your future interviews.
Hearing that from you is fantastic.
Well, thanks
so much, Jason.
You bet. Thanks.
Hey there, this is Future David again. You made it this far, so hopefully you enjoyed that conversation with Jason Fried. It still remains one of my very favorites. And if that conversation with Jason Fried has you primed to find your particular voice and nurture an original's mindset, I recommend you listen to Cards Against Humanity co-creator Max Temkin on episode 45. Hear what it was about Cards Against Humanity that made it so explosive that it is consistently the number one selling toys and games item on all of Amazon. Also remember Steve Case is on episode 25, Noah Kagan, episode 41, Ryan Holiday, episode 31, Laura Roeder, episode 9, Dan Ariely, episode 51, James Altucher, episode 53.
So, there we have it. Before I go, I gotta ask, do you like books? If you do, I'd love to send you my book recommendations. About 90% of them will be nonfiction on subjects spanning from biographies to neuroscience. Just go to cadavy.net/reading and make sure you put one more trailing slash on the end of that URL. Sign up and you'll get my first set of recommendations right away. You'll be supporting the show if you buy any of those books through the links in the email. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. The theme music for this show is See In You, performed by The Album Leaf, courtesy of Sub Pop Records. Love Your Work is a production of Cadavy, Inc.